It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine, and I'm delighted to be joined by Seb Halford's Floor. Hi, Seb.
Hi there, Joe Devine.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Yeah, also...
I'm deflated, actually.
Also here is John McKenzie.
Hello.
How are you?
I am flated.
You are flated. Yeah, I'm a little flated. I had a baked potato earlier. But also here... Much better than a baked potato is Kiva O'Neill. Hi, Kiva.
Thanks.
How are you?
I'm much better than a baked potato.
Are you happy about that?
Yeah, quite. But, I mean, my new Twitter bio feels.
Baked potatoes are very good.
Three of us had baked potatoes for dinner, so yeah. We all like baked potatoes.
We're all going to want to leave this room desperately.
I'm holding on.
The podcast. Anyway, fine. Well, listen, lots on the docket to discuss today. England are out, France go through, Portugal, Morocco. Story of the day. That's the one. That's the story. We should start with that. No, we'll start with England and we'll come back to Portugal, Morocco. But that's very, very, very exciting. And also, we've got points of bad a little bit later too. But have you had a fun day generally there, Kiva?
Yeah, I think the Morocco game is probably now the highlight. I went out into Trafalgar Square as well and met a few of their fans and they were just absolutely overjoyed. So that was nice.
Did you see Seb there?
I think I might have gone
you,
about 45 minutes too early.
Aww.
I got there and it was a kind of mix of tourists,
Christmas
shoppers. Was
you with the pyro?
No, I was kind of, I got in sort of the Charing Cross side and there was no theme to it. I was kind of imagining wild street parties with Moroccan flags and I just turned around and walked back to the office.
Yeah.
I should have stayed.
Were there lots of people there when you got there? Were there?
See my Twitter, loads of videos and it was good fun, very nice mood.
Well, if you like good fun and a very nice mood, then you should visit The Athletic. TheAthletic.com/TIFO. TheAthletic.com/TIFO. Do you know, I never open the app and don't have a very nice mood, huh? Mm. Huh? Yeah? What have you read recently, Seb?
Well, the best thing I think I've read is Alex Abnos and Jay Harris wrote a piece about all the Moroccan fans who were celebrating around the world after the quarterfinal.
Right.
So what I did is I kind of read it again and multiplied everything by about four to imagine what's now happening.
Yeah.
Because Moroccan fans are everywhere. They're kind of they're celebrating all over the world. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
And the guys do a great job of describing those scenes. So
I have some half Moroccan, half French family. Quite excited for them to be conflicted.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. That is quite conflicting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's kind of a win-win, you know, I suppose, in a way.
Do you speak to those members of your family?
Not really, no.
So it's kind of a neutral situation.
It's kind
isn't
of
it?
Neutral yeah. for me. Yeah. Not because I don't like
them. No,
sure. They just live in a different country.
You just don't care about them.
Going down a wormhole now, aren't we? Anyway, listen, I will leave you in the warm hands and the cool embrace of distant family members. Yes, England won to France. Oh, there we go. It's all over, John. Not for you, of course, because you're a neutral, which I feel like is worth saying before you start to analyse the game. Though you sound like you would support England, you actually support Scotland, and therefore you are very biased against England. No, I'm just joking. You're a neutral in terms of this game. Tell us what happened and tell us why you kept shouting game state the whole way through the match.
Well, in terms of the overall tactical battle between these teams, obviously the anti-Mbappe plan that was being bandied around in the media was Gareth Southgate's plan to deal with Kylian Mbappe. And I think it was very interesting to sort of work out how that actually broke down in the game. So on the board in front of me, we've got France. France playing a 4-2-3-1 here. And Mbappe plays on the left-hand side of that, right? And Mbappe is very lackadaisical, let's say, in terms of dropping back into defensive situations, right?
It's not really required of him, is it?
Well, that's the interesting thing, because you would think that in a defensive situation, what would happen if you were going to play like a 4-4-2 block, which a lot of teams do, you'll have your wingers dropping in, and then your number 10 will push up here alongside, and then you've got your two forward pressing players here, and then you've got two banks of four behind.
So you've got a sort of 4-4-2.
Yeah. And so the idea then is that if Mbappe is pushing up in these situations, right up on the left-hand side, and he's not dropping in alongside his teammates, then you end up with this situation where on the left-hand side, you've got a huge amount of space in this area on the left wing.
Or Teo Hernandez has a lot of space to cover left back. He had a tough game as well, didn't he? Is that partly because of the exposure?
Yeah. Well, I'll go on to talk about him. But actually what happens in these situations is rather than Mbappe being expected to drop in and help out in those areas, what happens is that Mbappe pushes across and Giroud pushes across. And actually Griezmann, I pronounced his name in a very weird way again.
Griezmann.
Yeah. Do you remember when he growled last time through it?
Yeah.
He really went pretty guttural. Yeah.
Griezmann drops in alongside Tchouameni and Rabiot pushes into this side a little bit. Mm. So Mbappe not helping out defensively is not as dangerous as you might think.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, there's still weaknesses on this side because Rabiot is technically playing in a double pivot alongside Tchouameni. But what was happening is that England were trying to make the most of this by pushing Saka forward. They're keeping Walker deeper. They didn't want to push him up. They're happy for Shaw and Foden to push up. But they were dropping Henderson out onto the wide right area here.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea being that they were going to try and get these overloads and build up in the wide area here. But Rabiot drops across. We've got Kane up here. And the problem then is that you have the situation where you've got basically matching your midfield here in Giroud or Mbappe dropping to help with the pivot in England's build-up too.
Yeah.
So actually what you're doing in this situation, the idea is to make the most of the fact that Mbappe isn't dropping in to help out defend, but actually France have a really nice system then for making sure that area is covered.
And they end up sort of overloading a bit in the middle.
Yeah, exactly. So you end up then losing some of these battles, I think, because Rabiot does stay a little bit more narrow here and you end up with a 2v3 in this sort of area. And England obviously want to build up on their left-hand side through Shaw and Foden because they don't want Walker to get forward too much. So it felt to me very much like in this game, the advantage you might think that you might get from Mbappe playing on the left-hand side was neutralized to a certain extent. Although, interestingly, as you said, the most dangerous dynamic, I think, for England was Saka on Hernandez. And England were constantly finding Saka, and he was just holding Hernandez off and then rolling. And a few chances were generated in this sort of area. Saka obviously wins the penalty as well. And then Harry Kane as well, I think, rolls up a Meccano in this kind of area as well. So they did get some upside from these kind of areas in the first half in particular.
Yeah.
But I think overall, the way that France played actually balanced quite nicely off the way that England would want to play as well.
Yeah. I mean, Kiefer, France's first goal kind of, maybe it's a bit unfair to say it came out of nowhere, but it didn't feel expected at that moment. And then it just completely changed the game, didn't it?
Yeah, I think it did come out of nowhere. It just sort of, Tchouameni just popped up and scored. And it felt like France have the capability to do that. And you felt like they might do that. They obviously did. England looked pretty in control and pretty confident. Probably England's best performance in a tournament, could you say? They played really well against tough opposition. But that goal sort of comes out of nowhere. I don't think it really matters or changes the game in any kind of way. England obviously then later get the penalty. Thought Saka was absolutely brilliant. But it's interesting that I think Kyle Walker goes forward just before they get the goal, and then doesn't really go forward again in the first half. He just kind of stays back then because obviously you've got Mbappe to mark and Mbappe actually is involved, although, you know, Griezmann will get the plaudits for obviously assisting both goals. Mbappe, he's like a spark. As soon as he gets the ball, it's like the electricity just starts running through the French team, and that's what seemed to happen. But I thought Jordan Henderson and Bukayo Saka were two of England's best players tonight, and they linked up really well. And then they just disappeared after, obviously, France got the second goal, which was a bit disappointing.
They also, but I mean, what did you make of Saka being subbed off? So he replaced by
Henderson was like, when he was sprinting 100 metres in the first minute, I was like, you got 70 minutes in the tank here with him. But Saka was quite surprising. I know Mount comes on and then obviously wins the penalty, but Saka was building up to this moment. It felt like this moment was coming and going to happen for him. And then obviously Southgate takes him off, and it just felt a bit like that was a deflating moment for everyone because we were all building up to this Bukayo Saka moment, and then we didn't get it, which was a bit sad.
A player that we did get lots of moments from was Hugo Lloris, who had quite a good game. Not to suggest at all that the outcome would have been different if he had a worse game. I don't think England had that many clear-cut opportunities, but Lloris certainly was an important player for France.
Yeah, it was a Spurs performance from him, in the sense that like he made his really good saves. He had a few iffy moments from crosses when we dropped a couple. And he's someone you always think you're going to get an opportunity out of, but ultimately in a game of those kind of thin margins, like the save he made in the second half, the one he tipped just over the crossbar, is one of the best saves I've seen him make. Kiva made a really good point during the game. He has this really unusual technique where you see him dive almost with his body before he puts out his hands. And so it always feels like any shot that's going towards goal is going to go in. And then at the last minute, he kind of puts out a hand to deflect it. He had a really good game. He's a big reason why France were in the semifinals. It's kind of measurable. So I know the mood is kind of down, but I was really happy with the way England played. I was really encouraged by kind of some of the personality in the performances. And
well, it's worth saying it was an interesting opportunity to see England at a major tournament against a big team like France. Like there's been lots of people talk before about the idea that England's progression through tournaments over the last couple of tournaments has been past teams that are under the elite level. And certainly France is the biggest opposition, I think, that England have faced at a major tournament for a long time. So it's quite exciting to see them. It was a very different game.
Yeah, I mean, it's bittersweet because I think the trend in these kind of games has been that England underperform, they are inhibited, they play like they did, for instance, against Italy in Euro 2012, where they're so aware of their inferiority, like from a kind of technical perspective, that instructs their performance. Whereas tonight, I thought they were aggressive for, you know, decent periods of the game. I thought like Bukayo Saka was excellent. I thought Jude Bellingham was very good. I enjoyed Phil Foden in moments. Like these are things you don't often say at the end of an England elimination. And I don't know, like I just think it's one of those things where I think France are just a better side. I think England probably played a little bit better tonight, but the lesson is like you take your chances. That's a really trite observation. I understand, but it's the truth. And it comes up in World Cups again and again and again.
Well, they didn't create enough chances. Like if you take the penalties away, which obviously you can't, right? But presumably the non-penalty XG would show that I don't think there were really that many clear-cut chances in open play for England. I agree that they were the better team, but less about taking chances and I think more about creating them, isn't it?
Yeah, so I've just looked at Opta's XG plot and they have England at 2.4 expected goals. Now, 1.6 of that came from penalties. Now, obviously, as you say, a penalty is a legitimate way of scoring and it's a good way of getting chances. But if you take that away, I think it leaves, what was it, 0.8 expected goals from open play. Well, that's not even from open play because obviously chances came from corners and set pieces as well. But this is the way that England have played, right? This is the way that you can game the system on the international stage, right? If you work hard on your set pieces, and if you have players who are going to win, I mean, England won those two penalties and will have to consider themselves unlucky to not still be playing right now as we record. But I would say, like, to go back, you asked me right at the beginning about game state, and I didn't really talk about.
Yeah, what is game state? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so game state just simply refers to the situation that a team are in at any one point in a game, and the various exigencies that might affect the way that they're playing. So, obviously, England were 1-0 down fairly early on. And that changes the way that England are going to play, and that changes the way that France are going to play. Because I think France came into this game expecting to try and get the first goal and then sit back and rely on the fact that they've got Mbappe, who's one of the best transitional players in the world. And they know then you can worry about England's attacking play and then just sort of vibe out in the wide left areas through Mbappe and hope that you pick up a second goal to go ahead. And then you can be a little bit freer. And I think that impacted the way that France played in the first half in particular. I think they're quite happy allowing England to have the ball. England were trying to build up in wide areas. They weren't generating a huge amount through the middle. There was obviously some dangerous moments. We've talked about the Kane role of Upamecano, and then there was the penalty situations as well. But I think France will look back on this and say, okay, a couple of silly head losses. So Tchouaméni jumps in a little bit on Saka, and then Theo Hernandez just barges through Mason Mount in a situation that actually I don't think was very dangerous. That's definitely tournament head loss territory.
Yeah.
Beyond that, they'll be fairly happy, I think, with the way they played.
That's the thing. Can I just interject quickly to just say as well, I think in this specific game, whilst yes, a penalty is stopping an open play opportunity that you know might have in the context of the XG conversation might have a healthy dose of that attached to it, or might just be able to create a good opportunity. I think in this game, it's not really the case. Like we've talked, in fact, there's a chapter of the book, Seb, about penalties and how sometimes they feel a bit unfair because the likelihood of scoring from a penalty is about 78%, right? Versus where you win a penalty from and the context of that situation when you win it is almost always significantly lower than that. The Mason Mount penalty, Mason Mount's not getting anywhere near that ball. Yeah. It's not dangerous at all. It's a stupid foul. Decision. It is a penalty,
was running backwards, but it's like, out of the penalty area as well. He could have got a shot away.
It's never, ever going to be a goal. As far as I'm concerned,
Harry Kane non-penalty.
That's 0.0 XG there. Yeah. So I think it's just, I don't know, it's interesting, isn't it?
But yeah, to come back to the game state, obviously England then get back in through the penalty, and then I think France came out a little bit more in the second half, and they had that period where they had a couple of chances in quick succession, got the goal, and then they sat back again and were a little bit more. If you look at the XG plot, it flattens out again after they score their second goal because they're not trying to go out and score, so being 2-1 up changes the way they're approaching the game. I think it's a pretty risky way of playing sometimes, but it's worked out for them in this occasion, and it was only Harry Kane yeeting a penalty over the bar that stopped them from suffering from that.
What did you make of that, Kiva? I mean, he'd already scored one, stood up to take the second, put it the same way and hit it over the top.
I felt really confident in him. And we were chatting and you said a lot of the time when he takes, I mean, all penalties are pretty pressurised situations. I don't know how they do them. But you were saying that sometimes he goes down the middle.
Yeah, it's one that he likes. I mean, he's such a good ball striker normally that like he's pretty reliable at finding the corners. I always think it's really tricky when you have to take twice in the same game, and also the added complication of Lloris being his club mate. I always felt as if like that's the banker penalty. It's the high percentage one, isn't it? And I don't know. It's I have seen him do that before. He missed a penalty very similarly at Southampton a few years ago. We just got underneath it and he struck it well enough, but it was nowhere near. It's really unfortunate for him as well, because I think he actually played pretty well. But obviously the headline is going to be a missed penalty, but then like, what do you do? It's got to be, in those moments after the penalty's given, it's going to be so easy to just get in your own head thinking, I've gone down that side. Do I go there again? He's my club mate. What's he thinking?
It was quite a weight as well.
It was a weight, and that's fine. Like, that's something you have to deal with. That's just part of it, but it adds to the pressure. And it's complicated. And you've got to be, emotionally, you've got to be so resilient, I reckon, to deal with that. I mean, one penalty's bad enough, right? But
part of me thinks, do you put Mason Mount, who wins the penalty, on the penalty, almost just to take that pressure off Kane? And if he misses it, all right, he's just come on, and then everyone will be like, why didn't Kane take it? But if he scores it, then, you know, we're not having that conversation. But Harry Kane scores penalties, and he always blasts them into the top corner. Goalkeepers can't get near them. That's what he was trying to do, and it just didn't come off for him.
I think the second penalty always adds like a level of psychology that you don't get with just a single penalty.
Yeah.
And so
it was like our second game of chess after I beat you in the first one.
The one where you collapsed.
The one where I collapsed instantly. Yeah. I mean, my game, that was not even the equivalent of Harry Kane's over the bar. Mine was, didn't even cross the goal.
Oh, scoring an own goal from a penalty. can that happen? If you hit the ball the wrong way, like, and it goes in your own goal.
It's a good question. Can you do that?
But that was basically what you did in that chess game.
That's why I did in that chess game. Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know.
Interesting.
The other thing I was going to say is that we've barely seen any players who take penalties in this World Cup go high with the ball. And there's been some conversation about the ball being a little bit lighter than maybe previous balls. And I think when you're in that situation, a really high pressure situation to keep your team in the game, and you go high, with that added adrenaline that you have in those situations, it's so easy to get those fine margins wrong and go high. But again, it's a horrible situation to be in. I've been in like amateur games that just do not matter and had to take penalties where you feel
at penalties?
I never missed a penalty.
Really?
This is embarrassing.
Bruno Fernandes.
Until one game.
John McKenge.
Where I missed two penalties in the same game. And I never took a penalty
after
that.
You Martin Palermo'd, really?
You never took a penalty again?
I won a penalty and took it to get... this is ridiculous. This is for my college at university against the comparative college at Oxford. So it was like a varsity game. Obviously, it's not important at all. But like, I won a penalty in the last 5 minutes.
It was important enough for him to bring it up.
Yeah.
I won a penalty in the last five minutes.
Where was it again? Say where it was again?
Yeah. What does that word mean? Mm. That sounds quite historic.
What is university? Yeah. Is that a
anyway? I won a penalty in the last 5 minutes of the game to win the game, and I clacked it, and it hit the angle of the post and bar, bounced down, like just in front of the line, and then was cleared.
Yeah.
And we went through, played extra time, and then went to penalties. No one else on my team wanted to take the one of the penalties, so I was like, "Fine, I'll take it," and I yeeted it over the bar. I have never felt more pressure than I felt in that moment.
Yeah.
Because my mind went blank. I was just like, "I don't know what I'm doing here." I was just like, "I'm just going to hit it as hard as I can."
And how did you feel after?
Oh, I felt awful. Joe.
Did you?
Yeah. Hard to describe how bad I felt.
Hard to describe.
Mm. I've got this real urge to like look up your university football history on Wikipedia. Is there like a page for it?
There will be tomorrow.
He's been trying to write it for quite some time, Kiva, but they just keep rejecting it.
There you go.
Okay. Well, listen, let's talk about France a little bit. I'm sure we can talk more about England after, but what did they do well, Seb? Because they won the game. They did that quite well.
I felt like, I mean, we have talked about him before, but I felt like Antoine Griezmann's like performance in open play, forget the assists, like his kind of ability to receive the ball. And I think despite England probably having the better chances, I think like France's authority over the game was slightly more pronounced at times. And that there's a big, you know, Griezmann does a lot of lifting in that area. And it's not stuff which catches your eye. If you go back and you were to kind of watch a supercut of Griezmann's performances, his passes and, you know, his retrievals and his receiving positions, he does a lot of the stuff that we praised Croatia for last night, which is takes the sting out of the game, eases the pressure. He's like a little bit of a pressure valve, which is so interesting to me because it's a reinvention of who Antoine Griezmann is as a footballer. Because I always think of him as a kind of an attacking player, and I think of his goal scoring and his kind of his flamboyant attributes. So I enjoyed that. I felt like, I mean, all the way through the tournament, I kind of thought that France would win the World Cup, and depending on what happened to Brazil, probably at a canter. And I still do back them against Argentina.
Do you think it could be France Croatia again?
Argentina, I think, would probably get through against.
No, I agree, but I mean, I'm just thinking it has the potential, right? Has there ever been two finals in a row with the same teams?
I do not know the answer to that. There might be a Germany, Holland somewhere in there. I'm not sure.
Is there an Argentina, Netherlands final?
Yeah, because they'd have been 78.
Yeah.
And
what about the following one? 82, you know, Brazil winning.
82, Brazil.
It seems like we can look this up another time.
We could probably do
86 and 90, apparently.
That would probably be
that's what people are saying.
Okay, yes.
Is that Italy, Brazil?
No, that would be 90 is Argentina.
Laszlo saying Germany, Argentina, 86 and 90.
And then in 86, Maradona inspires Argentina to beat Germany.
Although is one of them like West Germany and the other one not?
Yeah, West Germany. They're both West Germany. Okay. But yeah, anyway. Long story short, I'm not sure I trust that defense. Like the Hernandez,
they're a bit wobbly today, weren't they?
A little bit wobbly. I feel like some of Saka's moments, not just against Hernandez, but some of his moments cutting in from the right into the left, like the move which leads to the penalty is kind of about panic, isn't it? Because Hernandez, he goes away from his man, but also you watch Tchouaméni step back into a kind of screening role. And one of the big caveats about his move to Real Madrid was he's going to be a brilliant, brilliant player. There are some positioning and defensive issues that you're going to have to cope with as a young player. It's not criticism, he is inexperienced. They brought a kind of set of raw materials in a way, and there's a little bit of jitteriness, which if you think of Leo Messi in that situation and potentially Lautaro Martinez restored after scoring his penalty, maybe there's a bit of a problem. But I was really impressed actually by a lot of what France did. I mean, in a different way to how I have been through most of the tournament, I think they're just they're probably one of the best functioning Didier Deschamps sides that I've seen. Perhaps it's a little bit about, you know, them being a bit easier on the eye, but I think they're going to be very, very tough to beat.
I think it's worth saying that like a lot of the time it's easy to fall into results bias analysis of games, but France didn't have to do much to win this game. They obviously scored that goal from outside the box really early on. No one expected it, especially of Tchouaméni. And then
They
turned things around a little bit for about 10 minutes in the second half and sort of turned the screw a bit and then got the goal.
The Giroud-Maguire combo.
Whereas England, I mean, England had the two penalties and then they did create other chances, could have been much more dangerous. So that's the way international football goes. I think that they're unlucky to have not taken it to extra time for sure. Mm. Because you like Kiva was saying, like Harry Kane takes a penalty, you expect him to put it out. I didn't expect him to miss at all in that situation, even with all the pressure that was on it. But again, like so much of this comes down to France were trying to play the game in a really sort of professional way and not give too much away. And they knew that they probably had, that they were set to benefit if they could sit deeper and play in transition. And they want, and England did, I think, a good job of stopping France from playing in transition.
Yeah.
But the way that the game sort of ebbed and flowed for me was like France sat back a little bit in the first half, England get the equaliser, France sort of, the game then becomes a bit more bitty and balanced, then France get the go-ahead goal, and then England get, and then sit back a little bit more and England let England come to them. So yeah.
It's quite interesting though, isn't it? Because France, you know, I think the narrative around England and tournament football is pretty vibrant, let's say. But Deschamps' France is one of the inspirations for Southgate, right? Like the way that France play in tournaments is not dissimilar and is actually a direct influence.
It's the example used to diffuse criticism of Southgate time and again, and quite rightly, because look how successful they've been.
Yeah.
And also the model works. Like the game finished 2-1, yes, but like just minutes before Giroud scored, like he had probably a better chance to score. And like France have that, it's a slight Real Madrid quality in the sense that like the game can go against them and they can be under the cosh and they can be conceding chances and getting away with things a little bit, or, having refereeing decisions go against them. And yet somehow in that small moment in time, they're efficient enough to take advantage. Or, and I think honestly that Giroud header doesn't probably get enough credit because it takes a little bit of a deflection off Maguire, which is just unlucky for him. But Giroud has just missed a really, really good opportunity.
Like,
he should score. Definitely he should score. Good save from Pickford, but he should score. And there's a lot of players in the tournament, I think probably a younger player thinks, has a bit of a sulk about it, or goes into their shell, or look what happened to England after Kane missed his penalty.
Yeah.
There was still, there's still another 30 minutes left. And England just were gone. And Giroud's there to kind of to score the decisive goal. And it's very difficult to measure that quality and to put a label on it, but it's so important. And Giroud, like, look at Giroud's tournament. Like, look at the goals he scored and look at when he scored them. And like the variety of finishes. It's just a priceless commodity in a tournament. And he's as old as me and John. Like, it's crazy.
And he's still underrated.
He's still underrated. Yeah, absolutely.
And he will, even if France win the World Cup again, somehow he will continue to be underrated in a weird kind of way.
France's record goal scorer. Okay, so Mbappe will catch him before much longer. But what an achievement for a guy that probably until about his mid-20s wasn't really rated by anyone in the game.
And he came from Montpellier, didn't he?
Yeah, he won a title at Montpellier and he scored like... I think, without looking up, he scored a goal a game in Ligue 1 during that season. Had an amazing year, earned the move to Arsenal. And his Arsenal career is kind of a study of the way he's viewed everywhere. It's like, oh, you're not quite Thierry Henry.
His contribution to that Jack Wilshere goal, though, that is just, that's one of the best Premier League goals for me.
His career is littered with like amazing contributions. I think of like the Europa League final when Chelsea played Arsenal and his header in that game, or some of the stuff that he's been doing at AC Milan. For a guy of his age, it's amazing that he kind of remains sort of in the, sort of the position in the game sort of ecosystem that he does, just because he's consistently brilliant and he consistently makes the players who play around him better. He's a marvellous footballer.
And I think that point that you made, that he's almost energised by the first chance he has. And England in that moment to maybe just sort of switch off a little bit. Like, that was their big chance. They're not going to get a bigger chance than that. And then a minute later, they pretty much do. And Giroud is just there to...
He takes it. Yeah. And I think it goes in regardless of the deflection. Maybe it goes in, you know, but it's just, it's a good, really good, strong header from not very far out. I don't think Pickford ever has a chance. Like, the Maguire deflection matters, but it's a great contact nevertheless.
Can we talk about Gareth Southgate? Because I feel like a lot of the discourse about Southgate...
Let's have a break and then when we come back, we'll do that. Yeah.
Let's have a break then. Oh, what a wonderful break that was. Did you enjoy that break, people?
Oh, I enjoyed it. Yeah. Tell me more, John.
No, you have to go back to leading now. I've done my stint.
So you... Okay. What you've done though is you've done my bit and then...
Yeah, what do you think about Gareth Southgate?
Do you want me to do your bit? Should we swap places and I'll use the board?
Yeah.
No, I can't commit to the bit. Let's talk about Gareth Southgate, though, because, I mean, I've no idea what Gareth Southgate intends to do, but this is his third major tournament. It's very possible it will be his last as England manager. Don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, well, we talked a lot about the fact that we didn't really know what level England were at because they'd never really played many of these games where they play higher ranking teams. I think the stat is the last time England beat a team that were higher up the FIFA rankings was in 2002 when they beat Argentina. So obviously 20 years ago, it's a long time. And the big question about Southgate has always been, how is he going to set England up in these games against the teams who you would expect them to be slight underdogs against, right? And in this respect, like in this game, you've already mentioned that Deschamps and Southgate are similar in that they both want to sort of play very passive, fairly risk averse football and rely on the fact that they have better talent than the opposition. That's what happened to France today, right? Their talent won them the game. But I guess for me, like, I felt as though I wanted to see more from England in terms of, we talked about build up at halftime, and on the board again, we talked about how Giroud and Mbappe are going to be the first line of pressure in the French press, and that France do this sort of shifty around to make that work. In effect, these two are just the two worst pressers that you'll see.
You're talking about Mbappe and Giroud.
Yeah, Giroud and Mbappe. Like that first line of pressure is super easy to get around. And then you've got this situation where Griezmann is dropping in as a central midfielder who you wouldn't expect to see him in that kind of role. And then Rabiot is always constantly worried about the space that is left by Mbappe over on the French left-hand side. So I feel as though that England could have probably generated more dangerous attacking situations through build up and possession than they actually did in this game. And that's constantly been my criticism of Gareth Southgate, because these players all play for teams who are going to be very good in build up situations. They're going to be able to move the ball through build up patterns. And I think for me in this situation, there was a big chance for England to actually cause a lot of problems to France, because France do have Deschamps who isn't doing a huge amount of like technically tactical stuff.
So, Kiefer, let me ask you this then. Based on what John has just said, let's say, hypothetically, Southgate were to leave. A, who do you replace him with? Because it's not like there's loads of excellent coaches just sitting around, right? And B, given how little time a coach really has with an international team, what do you think the expectations should be in terms of the style of football that England play? Because John makes a fair point. They do have a large number of very talented players.
And those players are really young as well. So this team, I feel almost not strongly enough about Southgate and like whether he should go or stay. I don't really know, like, let other people decide, I guess. But I just feel like he's built this togetherness, but this squad is young and is going to go forward. And, you know, this is probably England's best performance at a major tournament that I've ever seen and probably for a long time. Whether, you know, he stays on and they build towards that Euros and then, you know, but I don't know where this goes, and I don't know sort of like what is the mood right now. Do people want him to go? Do people want him to stay? Like, I just don't know. He's not someone that would massively inspire fear into opposition. I don't think France tonight would be thinking like, oh, tactically England are going to like do something crazy, or I don't think he's that kind of manager that you necessarily leave. If he's a manager at a club and, you know, your team are playing against him, I don't think you massively go, oh no. But he's done such an amazing job with this England team, so you kind of wonder who gets the job after him and what kind of manager do they go for. Do they go for someone, you know, who plays a little bit more attacking? Or I feel like a lot of people will feel this way right now, like where do they go, what happens next?
It's interesting because also to Kiefer's point of where do they go, it's not like it was in the past when, you know, the England job was a kind of coveted job and that you might be able to go to the top, the first division and offer it to any of the managers.
It's
there and they would
job,
step it up
though.
It's definitely a lesser job. Like, you know, I remember thinking a year ago, well, Graham Potter would be a good English manager, wouldn't he, because, you know, why not, right? But like, Graham Potter is now the Chelsea manager, and you have to be honest, like, taking the England job, particularly if you are not English and therefore you don't have like necessarily a fandom of the team, it's not even a step down, it's a step into a different dimension, right?
Yeah, I think so. And also, like, to make your reputation as a coach today, I think you have to be active in a day-to-day sense.
Yeah.
I think you need to, for your ideology to become public and for people to kind of seize upon it, you need to be competing in the Premier League or, you know.
Is it also what defines a current coach as a good coach? Like, the areas that they make a difference now, the areas they focus on, are not to be found in international football, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think international management is kind of a loco and parentis situation where you're borrowing players, you're trying to meld people together in a very short space of time.
What does that mean?
It means that you're kind of like a temporary loco parent. So like if you're like a guardian, aren't you?
What did you say then?
Loco in parentis.
Loco in parentis.
In the place of a parent.
Yeah. Oh,
I see.
It means that, so whereas a kind of a, I always feel like when you get to an international tournament or like important international like Nations League games, I feel like there's always this caveat in the background about, well, we've only been together for a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks, or, you know, club systems, you know, are more important. They're difficult to break down, and we've got cliques in our squad. So all of this stuff is kind of, it creates a very murky context by which to judge a manager. And I feel that doesn't suit, like, if you aspire to be at the top of your profession in football, it doesn't really suit you, does it? To kind of operate in a, I mean, how many days a year do you get with those players? Like, what do you spend your time on if it's not on the training ground? Like, how do you build the kind of, the cultish following that so many top managers acquire? It's really hard. And it's also with England, it's kind of unprecedented, this situation, because we had, okay, so Glenn Hoddle leaves the England job in 98 because of comments he made to Matt Dickinson about disabled people. Sven-Goran Eriksson leaves because his relationship with the Football Association broke down. Fabio Capello resigned in protest at the treatment of John Terry. Sam Allardyce had the resigned in the wake of the Telegraph revelations and the kind of the pint of wine saga, right? So you've never really had the same situation in the kind of modern era where you're saying, right, is your tournament performance good enough despite the fact that you get on with all the players? Yeah. Seemingly, you don't ever really hear any kind of disgruntled stories about Southgate.
No, they like him.
They really like him. Yeah. The young players especially seem to like him.
Yeah. Dresses really well.
Yeah, well, you've never had the kind of like the, remember when David Bentley said what he did about Capello and him and Jimmy Bullard wanted to be kind of jokers in the squad, and Capello, you know, didn't really go for that. And Rob Green said that after his mistake in Rustenburg in 2010, Capello didn't talk to him for the rest of the tournament. Like, so you never had that stuff. With Southgate, he's liked, people respect him within the squad. The players seem to really enjoy working with him. Also, unusually, you have players individually playing at kind of the same standard they do for their clubs.
Yeah.
So one of the things that came up tonight was Saka's performance, and that was Arsenal Saka. That's the guy that's lit up the Premier League this season playing for England. Whereas in previous generations, you don't really, well, you never really saw that, or you saw someone kind of crowbarred into an awkward position, never quite maximized club performance.
Yeah.
So I'm going to sit on the fence in terms of what I think should happen, but it's a hard decision. It's not clear cut.
I think it is. I think it's worth saying that if he does go, he's done a very good job.
Hmm. Yeah.
I mean, you know, a final, a semi-final, a quarter-final in three tournaments, like for England, that's good, isn't it?
We've talked about high floor, low ceiling teams, and I feel like that's what Southgate has made England, and that's not to be sniffed at. It feels as though England have gone as far as they probably could in most tournaments. So like, if you look back on it and say, okay, you're going to lose to Croatia in the semi-finals, you're going to lose to Italy in the final, you're going to lose to France in the quarterfinals, people will say, you know, well, that's what we expect from this manager and this team every time. The big question is, like, would a different manager have taken them further in one of those tournaments? And I mean, it's a counterfactual, we'll never know, but that's always why there's going to be debate about Southgate, because there always is going to be people who think that that's possible.
But I guess the point I wanted to, we kind of made this a few days ago on the podcast as well, is that they have the same debate in France, right? With the exception of the fact that they won the tournament in 2018.
Well, they're having the same debate in Brazil right now with Chiche.
They have the same debate all around the world. Often you have it in a little echo chamber and it feels like you're the only national team fans doing that, but just not true.
I think it does come back to like what we're talking about in terms of what is expected of a manager, because you've mentioned Graham Potter, and like Graham, there will be lots of managers in the same boat as Graham Potter who will say, okay, at the moment I want to develop my club career, I want to be at the coal face of domestic football because that's where tactical innovation is happening. There's a tempo to the domestic game that isn't there in the international game, right? So if you're managing a Chelsea, you can be there every day. You're at the training ground. You're constantly trying to improve your team. If you're an international manager, you're meeting up with people with your squad every 2 or 3 months.
It must be so hard to appoint an international manager, because like I've been watching the chat and people are throwing names like Thomas Tuchel in, and
none of them would do it.
And it's like, well, first of all, no, I probably not. But also, why would they be good at it? Because there's no track record of them having done that job in the past, and the jobs are so different. I'm not saying that
it sounds fun though, doesn't it?
It sounds fun, but it's also I have no idea whether Thomas Tuchel would be a great or an awful England manager or just an average one, or it's just, it's really hard to know. And so it's a very, very difficult appointment to get right. And like John said, at any given moment, there just aren't that many people who are going to want to leave, who are in employment, who are going to want to leave a club.
No, for sure.
To do that job. It's
Kiva, say your name.
I've been thinking Serena Weigman. I'll just put that out there.
Good name.
I think let her win the World Cup with the Lionesses first and then do a thing with England. But I think
it's not a terrible idea.
A couple of people agree with you in the chat.
It's a good shout. But I've been thinking, because I noticed someone mentioned Pep Guardiola, and I've been thinking, you know, we're discussing this, but it is interesting that could Pep Guardiola, you imagine he's that brilliant of a manager, he could definitely win the World Cup with anyone. You feel like he could whip any team into shape and just win the World Cup with them. But then at the same time, they get such little time to craft you know, build that team. And
he's only done the Champions League with Barcelona, right? I mean, that would be the big criticism about Guardiola, is that in terms of like the Premier tournament, he can't do it with any other team.
Just completely different jobs. Like Pochettino is another name, I think, that will be probably maybe doing the rounds as well.
The irony here is that the two best tactical managers in the tournament have been knocked out.
Hansi
Flick and Luis Enrique.
Again,
that's like I talked about England being maybe like a high floor, low ceiling team, but you feel like with Spain and Germany, they're high ceiling, maybe low floor teams. And that's the issue, right? If you can't get your team through those lower rank games where you're going to play against sides who are just going to sit deep and cause you problems, then it doesn't matter. Like, you can, maybe either of those two teams, if Spain had got through past Morocco, if Germany had got through into the knockout stages, they could still be in the tournament right now. We would probably be talking about them as the favourites. But because they couldn't break down those lower blocks, because they didn't have the time to be as tactically, you know, subtle as you might need to be at that level, then it doesn't work.
Triffin Tart in the chat says, international football shouldn't have managers, just let the 26 players figure it out. Yeah, I quite like that idea.
That is so fun.
If you had one World Cup where there were no coaches allowed, no managers, only players, imagine the power dynamic, the power struggles.
Can you imagine the
controversies? 32 episodes of Succession.
Yeah.
I'd love it.
Well, Ronaldo technically is the Portugal manager anyway, right?
I think that is how it works, yeah.
That's a nice segue too.
Very nice segue, because next up, we're going to talk about Portugal 0-1 Morocco. You're very good at this, aren't you?
I know, I was going to say.
1 Morocco. What a fantastic... I tell you what we should do. We should have a break and then come back with a change of tone. What do you think?
Like it.
A little tone change?
In what direction, though?
Let's find out.
Okay.
Whoa! Portugal 0-1 Morocco. Am I right, Kiva, in thinking this is the first time that an African nation has made it to the semi-finals of the World Cup?
Yeah, I think you're definitely right in thinking that.
Oh, it's exciting.
Massively exciting. I think they've got the whole continent of Africa now behind them, and a lot of other people of England haven't gone out. I think it's going to be difficult for them against France, but what a performance. Just defensively, just sat there and just were magnificent. Been so good to watch. Knocked out some big teams. Now Portugal, another one. I mean, I was pretty... Portugal were just really underwhelming, I thought. Just offered very little. Never thought they were going to score at any point, really. And Morocco just held on. And yeah, just amazing. But I think I was thinking about their manager, Morocco's Walid Regragui. Am I right?
Regragui. I think is how they say it.
He only got the job 101 days ago.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of feed into that. Just give the manager the job like 3 months before the World Cup.
Yeah.
And that's
it's worked here and therefore.
Yes. It might not work going forward, but it'd be quite fun, wouldn't it?
I agree for sure, yeah. What did you like most about the game, would you say?
I think that Morocco won.
Yeah.
That was nice.
I think they did as well. What did you like, Seb?
Amrabat again. Anahi, who played on the right of their midfield, I thought was just, I don't know very much about him.
There was this moment in, what was it, 10 minutes before the end, maybe even like when Amrabat carries it past about six players out from his own corner flag.
So I've been reading up about the sort of the updates that have been coming out of the Moroccan camp, and he apparently needed a painkilling injection to get through the last 16 game.
Amazing.
And one of the things that we thought ahead of this game was that Rich Defar, right, because Amrabat is the heartbeat, he's so important as kind of the linchpin of that midfield, and he's the buttress for everything that happens, and you thought it's game too far, and he was absolutely magnificent again. And that moment, like, you're quite right, when you'd be tempted after sort of 82 minutes as a Moroccan player just to bang it as far as you can out the other end of the pitch. Beats two or three players, plays his way out of danger. He was magnificent. I really liked Anahi, the Angers player who I didn't know very much about, but I had a little look on FBref and at his profile, and he's, his sort of excellent taking players on, receiving progressive passes, that kind of thing. And that matched, that's from his club performances, obviously, and that matched up to his performance today. And I felt like he kind of typified Morocco in the sense that it's their football, it is resilient and there are defensive aspects to it, particularly as fatigue sets in. But I think they're really bold and brave too. Like if you look at their front three, those are so Buffel, El Nesri and Hakim Ziyech, those are three really kind of flair heavy players. And they play football. They're not they're not sitting behind the ball. They counter attack, they're expressive, and it's just a great story. And we mentioned the article right at the beginning about sort of the way their supporters celebrate. It's just so important that you have these moments in World Cups, because I mean, in this World Cup specifically, there don't seem to be very many fans from every country apart from Argentina and Morocco. And you know, if it was a sort of a France, I mean, I don't know how many France England fans there were in the stadium tonight, but it's not quite the same. And so what you get is this combination of bold, odds-defying football surrounded by this, I'm not even sure how to describe it, it's kind of frenetic Moroccan support.
Well, also, and it's not just, I think it's worth pointing out, it's not just support from people from Morocco now, right? There's the support of many of the people from the Arab world, many of the people from Africa whose teams either aren't there or are already eliminated. And one of the nice narratives around the World Cup is that it is the first to be hosted in the Middle East.
Yeah.
It's just, I mean, it's just like, isn't it kind of brilliant that you've got an African, North African team in the semi-finals?
It is. It's just important for football too. Ali Rogragi said after the game, I said before the game, I think before the, after the last 16, he talked about kind of some of the challenges that face managers, who coach in Africa or coach in the Arabic world. He mentioned the fact that, you know, someone of his coaching background would never get a job at Manchester City or Barcelona. And he's kind of got a point, right? Because if you look at what he's pulled off in this tournament, like if you look at the results that he's achieved, it's pretty staggering. And I know his goalkeeper played very, very well today. Bono was absolutely outstanding. Also, if you haven't seen it, lovely picture of him and his son on the pitch afterwards, and his son's wearing his goalkeeping gloves and they're absolutely massive. His son must be like so three cute. Or 4 years old, but his dad's gloves are enormous. It looks like, you know, in like a cartoon where
a character has large hands.
Exactly that.
Yes.
Exactly that. The kind of caricatured hands. It looks like that. And it's a very, very sweet moment. But what a success. Like it's just worked. They've been...
I
think what I'll take away from this game, beyond the individual performances, is the fact that Portugal, beyond that that one rasping shot from João Félix, created nothing.
Sure.
Like they were just contained, despite on came another attacking player, Leao came on and Ronaldo came on, and like this kind of revolving door of world-class performers.
Yeah.
And the door stayed shut.
Well, let's talk about the shut door, John, and how sustainable the idea is. I mean, I asked you... not long ago, can Morocco beat France? And you said no, but then also they shouldn't have beaten Portugal, and maybe we didn't expect them to win against Spain. Is it sustainable, do you think?
I think the big worry for me is whether or not they're going to remain fit enough and have enough players available to them. So you've got players dropping out, you've got obviously the amount of energy it requires to play this style of football is very high, and I think in the second half in particular we saw... Like the first half was incredible. We saw the Walid Regragui approach at its finest, and it just seems absolutely seamless to the low block and then the counter and their ability to manage the game to fall back into that low block, which is the ebb and flow of this kind of game, right? It's you sit deep, you absorb the pressure, and then you pick your moments to go forward, and it requires a huge amount of energy, a huge amount of intelligence to play that way. And then in the second half we saw it sort of looking a lot more raggedy, and by the end they dropped to a back five and they were sort of
six
holding
in the end, wasn't it?
Yeah. So but I think it's important to recognize that this isn't just boring low block football. I think a lot of people said, oh, wouldn't it be great if Morocco did a Greece? And I just think that's very unfair to what this team are doing, because this team has a system. They have they have their low block, and that their low block is very interesting, and they also have the players to be able to expand and counterattack.
Just to be specific, you're talking about Charlie Jones, the producer of the Totally Football Show, aren't you? Should we stir the pot a little bit?
He's using, let's be fair to him, he's using a turn of phrase there, which
of
is
of course,
you know,
as winning, they do on the Totally playing. Football yeah, Show, exactly. You know what I'm saying?
But only
the
only
inferior
the
podcast
here.
To so this one is that
we are the truth.
We've been watching the football with them. It's fine.
Do not listen to the others.
It's fine.
We're the prophets.
Go ahead.
Can I talk about pressing?
Please do. I love it when you talk about pressing.
Thanks, man. So what we've seen a lot of in this tournament, weirdly, is an approach to pressing which feels a little bit outdated. And that approach is to funnel opposition players into the middle to then spring pressing traps. So here, you might expect if Portugal are building up with the ball here, let's move all of these guys out of the way. They're building up with their back four. So we've got a back four here.
Now, remember the audio listeners.
Yes,
remember
we've got
those
back
people.
Four around the halfway line. Let's say the ball is with one of the centre-backs. Now, normally what you'd expect here is your forward to press against the centre-back and force the ball wide to the full-back. And in that situation, you'd expect your wide player, so Bufal in this instance, to go up and press against Dalot. But what you'll notice here is that by doing that, you're allowing a huge amount of space in between the fullback and the wide player.
In behind.
Yeah. So a lot of teams in this tournament actually have liked to do this because it forces the ball inside. And I think you can go player for player and it's just an easy way of doing a pressing system. But actually what we've seen Morocco doing, and I think this is because they recognize that a lot of teams in build-up phases are going to be much stronger in the wide areas, because you can overload in the middle, you can push them wide, and then you can have doubled up like fullback winger on the same player. And so what we've seen in these situations actually is that number eights in this instance pushing on the fullback. So you'll have Amala here just pressing onto the fullback, and what you're doing then is you're saying, okay, if you can work it past us, we've got the ability to just drop in here into the middle, into the central area. If you get the ball past our press, then you can have the center ground, but we're not absolutely going to let you have any space or time in the wide areas. Because I think a lot of creative players just like to drift out wide because they know they'll get space and time on the ball. And this approach has just been super important for them. So the eights push up, really aggressive press, and opposition teams just have not been able to actually cause any problems from these sorts of situations.
One more point about the coaching. Like, if you think about the stuff that Morocco have lost in this tournament, okay, so Saïss had to go off injured in the first half. Agüerd was injured in the last game. And obviously, Mesraoui is a big loss as a fullback. It's one of the very, very best fullbacks in the world. Will become one of them. And yet still, they retain this resilience. I think that's really impressive, because if you think about, I think it's a conversation we've had in England, not necessarily this tournament, but over the years, if you lose that one player who's really, really important to you, then your tournament's kind of over. That's sort of the mentality, whether it's true or not. Morocco have adjusted around everything that's happened to them. And that's just coaching dexterity, right? That's got to be factored into kind of our appreciation of their run here.
Yeah.
I think my favourite thing about them is that the families have been allowed in the team hotel.
Yeah, it's lovely.
And I think this has been like this big thing that, like, you know, England over the years, like the families are in hotels elsewhere because, you know, that would distract them. This is not distracting Morocco, it's inspiring them. And you're seeing that in the scenes at the end of the game when you're seeing, you know, Hakimi and his mum giving him a big kiss and a hug.
That
was just gorgeous moment.
And his mum. Like, yeah,
and you can see that this emotion and everything isn't getting to them in a negative way. By far, it's a positive thing. And it's, you know, that's the fight and the playing for the families, for the country. And you can really feel that. And that's why it's such a nice story to get behind and a nice team to follow now for the remainder.
It's quite an interesting idea, isn't it? Because you associate with, I think, professionalism and maintaining calm in a football game, a coldness or like a lack of emotion.
Sterile focus.
Sterile focus.
Yeah.
It's not clear to me that that's always the way that it works, is it? I mean, is that how it would work in a normal life?
It presumably has. It must depend on the personalities involved. Like, for certain groups, it suits them to have to have their families around them. To others, it is a distraction. I don't know.
I think
no
what,
idea,
what people but, mean when they talk about emotion in football, they mean kind of wild emotion where someone is liable to lash out or let their emotions get the better of them.
Yeah.
But often that, you know, the response to that is not to be without emotion. Like, often You can be at your most calm or satisfied or you know, tranquil or whatever when you are emotional.
Well, also, like, a tournament is going to be, for most players, a real roller coaster. Mm. So wouldn't you want, you know, your wife or your mum and dad or like whatever around you as a sort of as a comfort? I mean, it's pretty cutthroat environment, a World Cup. Like, yes, okay, one team goes on, wins, and more often than not wins all of their games and goes undefeated. For others, it's having to bounce back from adversity in very short spaces of time,
yeah,
and having to kind of exist in this this arena of kind of hyper focus, where the news cycle is unusually ridiculous, or even more so than it normally is. It's.
Do you know who I'd want around me?
Is it JJ?
No. It's my distant French Moroccan family.
You're just trying to recover ground and repair damage that you did to your family relations earlier in the episode. Yeah.
I'm reading a book at the moment called Intangibles by a US journalist called Joan Ryan. It's all about team chemistry, essentially. And she speaks to a lot of people working in particularly baseball, but also talks to a lot of neuroscientists as well. And there's a lot of weight put on this hormone called oxytocin, which is supposedly released in certain situations and is released through things like naturally occurring and released through things like hugging when those moments when you are able to, I think a lot of it comes down to mirror neurons as well. So when you see something happening to someone else, it releases this.
Like when you see a really cute dog on the tube.
Yeah, exactly. And
you see someone else see a really cute dog.
Yeah, so we see things happening and we are able to mirror those. We can mirror the feeling that those things are producing in other people.
Yeah.
But I think that obviously the ability to have your family around you, I think, is going to be really important in that sense, and that it's going to produce this hormone that actually.
If you like them,
yeah. I suspect if you don't like your family, probably don't take them with you to a World Cup and have
don't
them
take
in your hotel.
Them. Yeah. Each to their own. Mm-hmm. Okay? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, fine. Well done to Morocco and Portugal. I'm bored.
I feel that's a massive failure.
Yeah, I guess we probably should talk about it. Well, let's do it quickly though, and maybe we'll talk about Portugal a lot more, but go ahead.
I just think with the squad that they had, this was you can't dress it up in anything other than it's just ugly reality, failed. There was no creativity. Like, look at the different look at the different footballers that were introduced over the course of the game, and not one of them seemed to shift the needle of performance at all. Like, you're talking about the ability to bring someone like Cancelo off the bench, or Leao, or Vitinha came off the bench. It's an extraordinary level of talent, and then just not to produce any kind of attacking thrust. Also, it's kind of disappointing because I spoke to our friend Thiago, and a lot of the Portuguese players had a couple of them had a very negative response to the referee, which seems, I don't remember much that was particularly controversial about this game. Certainly, no, it wasn't in the kind of the Argentina-Netherlands bracket. And yet there've been quite a few comments, which are only now being translated into English. So I want to kind of leave them alone. But yeah, there's been a bit of a backlash in the hours since their elimination. And I just think the fault was no one's, but there's just a really poor performance.
Yeah. Okay, fine.
Can I just say one more thing?
Do you desire to speak?
I do.
Yeah, okay.
I was just going to talk about Portugal. Like, I mentioned that in the first half, Morocco were really, really excellent at keeping Portugal quiet. And in the second half, it got a little bit ragged. But in the second half, I mean, Portugal only put up about 0.89 XG, according to Opta, in the second half as well. So even when Morocco were a little bit more raggedy in their second half, they were still stopping Portugal from generating dangerous chances. And I think, again, that's a really incredible ability to be able to. I think Portugal in the end had 72% possession, and I think if you looked at all of the chances that Portugal had, the average expected goals for each shot was around 0.06 or 0.07, and what you would expect from those sorts of situations is something closer to 0.12. so, you know, you're talking about double what actually you might expect. So really good effort by the Moroccan team.
Yeah, also, like, the centre back El Yamek, I think he plays for Valladolid. I haven't seen very much of him before, but every time, like, there were so many Portuguese attacks, we seemed to end with him making a heady clearance, and it was amazing how often, like, Portugal went back to that route. Morocco dealt with everything that was arrowed into their box, like, and so just shelling a penalty box for, you know, 60 minutes when you need a goal seems a really strange really strange approach, but he was excellent. He was so resilient, and he dealt with absolutely everything at the back post as well, which is very, very impressive. Don't know much about him, but I like him.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, there we go. Now let's play Points Are Bad.
Ooh.
And I'm very excited to play this. Do you know why? Really
have you bad. Won?
No. Okay. What's the next best thing JJ that can losing. Happen?
That's the thing you like most.
What do you think JJ hasn't done? JJ Bull texted me 43 minutes ago to ask if he needed to send Points Are Bad.
Oh, that's...
He's had his one reminder. I've said yes.
Why would he not need to do it?
I texted him back yes 1 minute ago and said, you have 60 seconds. But he's out in the pub. There's no way he's doing it. Do you know what I think he's doing?
Blue-ticked the message?
He hasn't blue-ticked it. I think he's solidifying the not trying.
I think
that he's deliberately not sent them to gain 10 points so that when you win, he can go, oh, I got that 10 points because, you know, whatever. So it's not a legitimate... He's going to try and make out it's not a legitimate win. Can you imagine? Should we try to get him on the phone?
The thing is, though, he's only going to accrue 5 points, isn't he?
What could go wrong?
One game he's going to miss.
He's been drinking for hours, so lots could go wrong. But
it is also live.
I'm on the live stream as we speak. Are you happy to go on loudspeaker without saying anything terrible? No, I just want you need to give us. Okay, I'm putting you on loudspeaker now. Don't say anything
bad. Please do not swear.
Don't say anything bad.
Yeah.
Okay. You're fine. We can hear you. JJ, you need to tell us what your prediction for Argentina Croatia is, please.
Oh, thank you so much for telling me that. Argentina Croatia, I think, is going to be Argentina 1, Croatia 0.
There we go. I fuck up on him. Argentina 1, Croatia 0.
But
felt a little bit JJ like phone a friend.
Yeah, it was a little bit, wasn't it? Was JJ supposed to be...
It doesn't matter if he was supposed to go first, because the alternative is you win and he pretends it's not a legitimate contest. Okay. We don't want that. Okay. We don't want
JJ's
that.
JJ's definitely in the pub now, still chatting to you, by the way.
That would be fun. That'd be fun for him too, you know. I'm a nice person to chat to. Fine. Listen, let me tell you the results from today. JJ Bull was not supposed to go first. He was supposed to go last because he had a very, very good day.
So if one of us goes for Argentina 1, Croatia 0, does that mean he gets 5 points?
He sent us 3. He's now sent me 3, so we can change them if we want to. Thank you for that. There we go. He says he promised he'd written it down, but maybe I guess he hadn't sent it. There we go. JJ Bull wins the day with only 2 points, 1 point gained on each game there. Pretty impressive day from JJ, obviously trying today. Seb Stafford-Bloor, you're second with 3 points added. 3 points all added in the Morocco-Portugal game. Shocker. Because, of course, you got a perfect score with France, England. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Well done.
Thank you.
John, you came third with 4 points, just one off in the England game. The 3 added in Morocco, Portugal, and I came last with 10.
I can't believe that your 5-0 prediction for England didn't come through. Though,
I picked up 4 points on my 3-2 Portugal prediction, and I picked up 6 on my 5-0 England prediction. So I think it might be curtains for me at this stage. But JJ's given us his prediction. Let's see. You've both probably forgotten what it was by now.
It was
1-0. Definitely forgotten.
1-0 Argentina.
Great. There we go. Now everyone's remembered again. Me to go first.
Go 1-0.
1-0 Argentina. I mean, I could go 1-0.
1-0 Argentina.
And you guys would have to guess.
1-0 Argentina.
I think it's going to be 2-1 to Argentina. John, you're next.
This is horrible, isn't it? Because they like draw. They always draw. That's the thing, isn't it? They go to penalties.
You can guess the draw.
Yeah, but guessing and draw is boring, isn't it?
I mean, yeah, but like also you do need to do well. There's not many opportunities for you to do well anymore. This is.
I have to do well.
This is one of the final.
You're telling me that points are bad, Joe, at this late stage in the competition.
Check your contract.
This
John
is
McKenzie.
One of the final 4 opportunities for you to gain.
Well, before this, I wasn't trying, but now that you've told me that points are bad,
just say 1-1. Come on,
1-1.
There we go. Exactly. Seb Stafford-Bloor, what do you think?
1-0 Argentina.
You think 1-0 Argentina? Fine, which means JJ is now a 0-0. That was his second choice. Which, again, is very trying. That's very trying. That's it. I can tell you that the grand totals after day 21, I'm in last place, obviously, with 144. It's fine.
Did we listen to the song?
Oh, no. But we'll listen to the song afterwards as the outro.
Should we fade out the song?
That's all I came here
There's
for.
There's two people here today that are better at my job than I am. That's good, isn't it?
I've been waiting to listen to the song, so...
In which case, you should also read out the final ones of these. So I've read my score. Next up is John.
1, 3, 4.
Oh, 1, 3, 4. That's not bad.
I'm 10 ahead of you.
You're 10 ahead of me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yesterday, there was a 10-point gap between first and last. Now there's a 10-point gap between fourth and third. Next up, we have...
131.
And it's JJ in second place because Seb Staffordblore in first place with...
128.
Oh, lovely.
Surely no one's coming back.
It's a 3-point gap.
No one catches.
Four games left.
Don't do that.
No one can catch you.
You're trying to sell
me. You're so safe right now.
Listen, what you have to do now is hope that JJ goes first or goes ahead of you, right? And all you have to do is choose things that are less, the one away from his prediction. So even if you both pick up six... The worst thing that could happen is that John can sneak
it.
Someone in the chat has pointed out that had Joe failed to give any scores for this last set of games, he would still have had the same amount of points. So you might as well not play.
Yeah, that is true, isn't it? That is true. But it's all about the thrill of the game.
It is. It's the taking part that counts, not the winning.
Let's get our headphones ready.
Yay.
And while we do that, I will say thank you to
John McGenzie.
There he goes, John McGenzie. Hope you had a nice time. Thank you.
Yeah, I had a lovely time.
Thank you to Seb Staffordblore.
I had a very nice time. Thank you.
A special thank you to Kiva O'Neill.
Thanks for having me again.
Round of applause.
And round of applause. Yeah. And thanks to the production suite of Don and Jamie, who are going to outro us now. Oh, thanks to editor Nathan, who's back. Oh, yeah. Thank Christ.
That was not good for you last night.
I didn't like that.
No, you didn't like that. Yeah. No.
They're going to outro us with Points of Sad. And one more quick thanks as well. To Tom Hawkins, who provided us the Points of Bad sheet. We mentioned that at the beginning, but this has been a lifesaver for us during the tournament. So thank you, Tom Hawkins. And now we play out with Ban Summer's Points of Sad. Points of Bad.
That's nice.
Okay, cut it.